Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story is your new daily deep dive into one big news story. And it's coming soon, Monday to Friday, from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts to find out more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 22nd of November, these are our main stories. A temporary ceasefire is imminent in the Gaza conflict. Israel and Hamas have agreed to a release of some prisoners. The battle at the heart of artificial intelligence. 3 days after being sacked, the founder of OpenAI is back. So what's going on? We'll look at a new report that claims China is closing and destroying mosques to curb the practice of Islam. Also in this podcast, the Senate in France is debating a bill to compensate people prosecuted under anti-gay laws that were repealed 4 decades ago. And it's Kimchi Day in South Korea. How has the fermented vegetable dish become such a global phenomenon?
Koreans were making kimchi overseas. Then the global pandemic has really pushed its popularity. Nowadays, food isn't just consumed for taste, but for its health benefits.
We start in Gaza, where the guns and missiles are still firing in the conflict with Israel. But as we record this podcast, we've heard that a pause in fighting will start at 10 hours GMT on Thursday. More than 6 weeks after the war began, a temporary ceasefire was voted through by the Israeli cabinet in the early hours of Wednesday morning. Alongside it is an agreement to release Palestinian prisoners in exchange for some of the people kidnapped by Hamas last month. Itay Chen, a soldier with the Israeli Defense Forces, is believed to be one of the hostages being held by Hamas. His father, Ruby Chen, said news of the deal had brought mixed emotions.
I am joyful for my extended new family members that will become whole again because they are getting their loved ones back. But this is not the end. It's only the beginning of a journey that needs to end with the release of all of the hostages. I think we need to thank President Biden and the administration for taking such an active role in the negotiation to make this happen. And I think we need to urge the international community to do what it can in order to bring back home all the other hostages.
Because presumably your son will not be among the 50. Have there been communication with you about prospects for his release?
Not directly, but we do have hope that a framework that is in place now can be a sign of hope for other deals to happen in the near future.
So presumably then, every release, every moment that a truce is observed, all these things which in theory should happen over the next few days, you're going to be watching incredibly closely.
Yeah, and I think there's another component to the deal about the hostages left in Gaza, that they would be able to receive visitation from the International Red Cross, which is something so basic that has not happened for 48 days.
Have you had any indication what state your son is in?
No indication whatsoever. Again, with the lack of the International Red Cross, Doctors Without Borders wanting to go in, wanting to visit, which is part of the international law, which the Hamas terrorist organization has not been abiding to. We have no information about our loved ones, which if you want to think about it for a second, do you have kids?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know where they slept last night?
I do.
I don't.
Ruby Chen speaking to James Copnell. Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, a Palestinian politician and leader of the Palestinian National Initiative, gave us his reaction.
I'm very happy that the Israeli prisoners will come back safe, at least 50 of them, as well as 150 Palestinian prisoners. These are not just any prisoners. I mean, the Palestinians are children and women. I think what happened broke at least three of the Israeli taboos. There is no place for ceasefire, just what they called humanitarian pause. But what we've seen here is an agreement about a ceasefire. Israel was talking about bringing the prisoners only by force. Now they accepted what they didn't want to accept, which is exchange of prisoners. And they spoke all the time about destroying Hamas. Now they're making an agreement with Hamas.
Ilan Levy, an Israeli government spokesman, said that the deal by no means signals an end to Israel's war with Hamas.
Of course, nobody likes this, but Hamas is holding 240 hostages, including over 30 children. We have a moral obligation to bring them home, so we're holding our noses and we're doing what we have to do. This war has to end with the end of Hamas.
Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, told me more about how the prisoner and hostage swap will work.
Gaza, of course, much of it is rubble, is ruins, and these hostages have been hidden for the last 6+ weeks in tunnels, in underground basements, in bunkers, possibly some even in private homes. Hamas does not want Israel to know where it's hidden them. They are going to be escorted out by the International Committee of the Red Cross through the Rafah crossing, so the southern exit of Gaza into Egypt, and from there they will go to, they'll be taking to Israel for a medical examination, for checkup, because you know they will have been in really rough conditions. Some of them will probably be quite frail and have got even disabilities, some of them. The danger, I think, in all of this is that there is no trust between either side. They absolutely hate each other. And there is always the risk that a spark could disrupt this. Hamas is not the only armed militant organization in the Gaza Strip. You've got Palestinian Islamic Jihad. The place is awash with Kalashnikovs and very, very angry people, particularly young men. So there is always the risk that somebody is going to try and take a pot shot at the hostages as they leave, or that one side or the other will blame the other for breaking the temporary truce. So the Arabic word being used for this by Hamas is hudna, which means a truce. It's not quite the same as a ceasefire. And the two sides have completely conflicting views of this. Hamas would like the pause in the fighting to be as long as possible, preferably indefinite. Israel would like it to be as short as possible because they want to finish off Hamas.
Yeah, we heard that from Ilan Levy just a few moments ago, didn't we? There is the potential for this temporary truce to be extended a little bit if more hostages are released. But it's very clear Israel, as soon as it's got perhaps all its hostages out, will come down again very hard on Hamas.
Yeah, so the structure of the deal is that after the initial 50 Israeli hostages are released in batches of roughly 12 a day for the next 4 days, assuming that goes ahead, thereafter, for every 10 hostages that Hamas release from Gaza, Israel will pause for one more day. But there is a finite number to those hostages. We don't know how many may have perished in the bombardment of Gaza by Israel over the last 6 weeks. One Hamas official said 60 have died in that. Both sides have said that they are going to resume hostilities. So Israel has made it very clear the war continues. And in Hamas's statement that it put out early this morning, their time, it said our finger is still on the trigger. The war is not over.
Frank Gardner, our security correspondent. To another twist now in the tech world that we've been following on the Global News podcast over the last few days. Generative AI is the extraordinary new technology at the heart of chatbots like ChatGPT. It works by predicting what's likely to come next. But even ChatGPT is unlikely to have predicted the recent chaos at the top of one of the sector's leading companies, OpenAI. Just days after he was unexpectedly fired by the board, the founder, Sam Altman, is back as CEO. Colleagues had stood in solidarity with Mr. Altman, signing a letter calling on the board to reverse its decision. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, has been trying to gauge why all this is happening.
It's been an absolutely chaotic few days at one of the West's most successful and possibly best known artificial intelligence companies. Basically, what happened on Friday was the board of directors at OpenAI suddenly fired Sam Altman, who was the CEO and co-founder of the firm. It said that he hadn't been consistently candid with them in his communications, and as a result, they'd lost confidence in him. Now, we still don't know what was at the heart of that decision, but it's a pretty sudden and dramatic thing to do. So whatever it was, it must have been quite significant. And then over the weekend, there were these rumours that maybe he was going to come back. We saw him going into OpenAI. He put a picture of himself on social media saying he was wearing a guest pass lanyard for the first and last time. And everyone thought, are they going to have him back again? Is this what is going on? And then on Monday, he announces, no, he's not coming back. He's going to Microsoft. Now, Microsoft is one of OpenAI's biggest investors. It's invested billions of dollars in the firm and in its tech. It's put the tech that underpins ChatGPT, that's the viral chatbot that belongs to OpenAI. They've put that into their Microsoft 365 Office apps that's used by millions of workers. So you can imagine they're probably watching this extremely closely, thinking, what on earth is going on? So on Monday, we've got Sam Altman about to start work at Microsoft to run a team that they're going to set up for him. And then fast forward to yesterday, we have almost all of the people who work at OpenAI, that's around 770 staff, signing a letter saying, if Sam Altman doesn't come back, we're going to go. And guess what? This morning, he's going back.
And Zoe, why does this matter more than any normal boardroom battle?
Well, I think what matters about it is that the stakes are so high. There are very few companies in the West with their hands directly on the wheel of this powerful tech that's going to influence all of our lives. And Sam Altman is one of them. And you can see by the way Microsoft snapped him up so quickly that they don't want to lose him. Now, it sounds really dramatic to say it, but lots of people really do think that this technology will either save the world, you know, perhaps it will find us a solution to our climate crisis and help us to save the world, or it could destroy us if it's misused, if it goes rogue. You know, the stakes are that high. And so we are really looking at a kind of life and death battle playing out. And I think that's what makes it a bit different. It's not only the billions of dollars at stake, although there are those as well. We're literally talking about the tech that could be our future.
That was our tech editor, Zoe Kleinman. A prolonged drought in northeastern Spain is getting worse. 3 years of barely any rain have left Catalonia's reservoirs 80% empty. The regional government says it's experiencing its worst drought since records began more than a century ago. Ed Horton reports.
It's been called a critical moment. After 3 years of very little rain, the authorities are warning that fresh water might have to be brought in by boat to Barcelona, Spain's second largest city. Water levels in some reservoirs in Catalonia are so low that once submerged buildings like bridges and an 11th century church bell tower are now reappearing. Town halls have stopped filling public fountains and private swimming pools can't be filled. Local officials have urged Catalonia's roughly 8 million people to limit water consumption, and new restrictions will be imposed in the most populated areas in the region. But with the lack of rainfall predicted to continue, officials say this may not be enough and they could declare a water emergency by the end of the year, meaning still tougher curbs.
Ed Horton, so as we've been hearing, in a year where extreme heat, wildfires, floods and other natural disasters have been making headlines, Google Trends now says there has been a dramatic rise in online searches around stress and climate anxiety. The data was shared exclusively with BBC 100 Women. Lucy Gilder is our reporter from that team and has been telling me more.
We asked Google to provide us with data on searches related to climate anxiety in several world languages. The data doesn't measure the total volume of searches all over the world, but it does give us an idea of general trends. So compared to 2017, for example, searches related to climate anxiety in English have risen by 27 times. In Portuguese, have increased by 73 times. In Chinese, by 8.5 times. And in Arabic, by a fifth. And we also asked Google for a ranking of countries most commonly searching for queries related to climate anxiety. And the data showed that Nordic countries had the biggest share of global search queries related to this topic over the past 5 years. So Google also told us that it noted a global increase in search queries about the future of the planet, together with queries about the environment in the last year. So, for example, how to solve climate change was one of the trending queries about climate change in the past 2 years. And I think ultimately what this data is telling us is that there appears to be growing interest in and awareness of climate anxiety, along with feelings of distress about climate change and what to do about it.
And Lucy, there's already been an academic study, hasn't there, specifically into women's concerns about the global climate?
Yeah, so there's a major survey done of 10,000 young people from all over the world asking them about their emotional responses to climate change. And the findings were really interesting. So it found that substantially more women than men reported feeling concern and other negative emotions about climate change. Whereas men, on the other hand, reported feeling more optimistic and expressed greater faith in government. And this has been backed up by other recent surveys and studies too. And experts say this is partly because women tend to be more upfront about discussing climate emotions than men, but also because women feel more vulnerable to some of the impact of climate change. So there's even some research which suggests women in poorer countries are more likely to die in climate-related disasters. And this is because of various factors, such as not being able to travel to a place of safety or because of caring responsibilities. Here's Professor Susan Clayton, who co-authored a study which was based on the survey of 10,000 young people I mentioned earlier.
There may be greater food insecurity because in some cultures it's normative for men to eat first and the economic resources to be prioritized towards male children. After an extreme weather event, you frequently find increased levels of domestic violence. Pregnancy and reproduction, women are often more physiologically vulnerable to climate change. Certainly, you know, high temperatures and air pollution are associated with preterm birth. All of these things sort of put them at more physical risk as well as at more mental health risk.
So ultimately, I think what this data shows is that people are being more reflective about climate change and what it means to them. And there is some evidence out there which suggests that women may be feeling more anxious about climate change than men for various reasons.
Lucy Gilder from BBC 100 Women. A mysterious dog illness is spreading in parts of the US. The vets are baffled by what's causing it. More than 200 cases have been documented in the state of Oregon since August. It is fatal in some of the dogs. Sunita Naha has more.
The infectious disease was first noticed in Portland, in Oregon. Since then, it's also been reported in the states of Colorado, Illinois, and New Hampshire on the East Coast. Experts, however, suggest the illness could be far more widespread. Symptoms include coughing, sneezing, nasal and eye discharge, lethargy, and loss of appetite. Vets say the disease is similar to kennel cough in dogs, but lasts much longer. Dr. Kurt Williams, an expert at Oregon State University, says dogs can usually recover from a respiratory illness, either on their own or with the help of antibiotics. But he said this was not the case with this illness. There's no official count of how many dogs have been affected. And Dr. Williams urged dog owners not to panic, but to ensure their pets are up to date with vaccines, while vets pin down what's making them ill.
Sunita Naha. Coming up in this podcast, we hear how sexual violence against women has become a deliberate tactic in Sudan's civil war.
The level of dehumanization of women in Sudan, it reached a level where it became extremely scary and very, very worrying.
Every weekday morning, wake up to one big story from the African continent.
Where does Africa stand in this conflict?
How is Africa responding to the refugee crisis?
With me, Alan Kasuja, and Africa Daily.
So what's it like living in an area where Boko Haram are active?
One story from Africa, for Africa.
Our story.
Africa Daily.
That's Africa Daily from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
China is closing, destroying and repurposing mosques. That is the allegation by Human Rights Watch in a new report. It's part of a systematic effort to curb the practice of Islam in China, according to the organisation. There are about 20 million Muslims in China, which is officially atheist, but says it does allow religious freedom. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, is following this story.
Human Rights Watch has been in contact with people in Gansu and Ningxia. These are two regions in the west of China where Human Rights Watch say that the Chinese authorities have launched this attack on mosques. And they've documented from these people, as you said there in the introduction, efforts to close down, decommission or demolish all these mosques in an effort, what Human Rights Watch says is to restrict the practice of Islam, but what the Chinese government might say is to kind of restrict the more extreme elements of Islam. That's how the Chinese justify this kind of policy. Also, what the Chinese are doing, according to Human Rights Watch, and this has been documented by other media outlets as well, including us, the BBC, that the Chinese government is trying to change the architecture of mosques by getting rid of things like domes and minarets, things which it doesn't believe is traditional Chinese architecture. Essentially, it wants to make these mosques look more Chinese.
So you say that from the government's point of view, they would say, well, we'll try to restrict more extremist elements of Islam. Do you think that's how many people across China see it? Where do they stand with regards to Islam?
Well, it's a complicated situation, and many people in China, the majority of Han Chinese people, they're kind of not Muslim. They don't live among Muslim people. And there's been some scepticism growing over recent years, which is partly what's driving this policy. But I think overall, the Chinese government for many years has tried to put religion in a box. It says it allows religious freedom, but essentially it wants religious people, all religious people, to be good Chinese citizens before thinking about their religion. And Islam is no different to that.
Mickey Bristow. Now to India and to a story that we've been following for more than a week now. Drilling has resumed near the mouth of a tunnel in India's Uttarakhand state, where 41 workers have been trapped. Our correspondent Samira Hussain has more on the efforts to free the men.
It has been 11 days since a nearby landslide crushed a partially built tunnel, trapping 41 construction workers. Rescue efforts have been hampered by poor machinery and unstable ground. A new drill is now up and running at the mouth of the tunnel, but crews are also trying to reach the workers by drilling 4 additional access points. Officials on the ground believe they will be rescued within the next 48 to 72 hours. But family and friends of those stuck inside are growing increasingly frustrated, wondering why it is taking so long to get them out. In a recently released video, the men can be seen wearing hard hats, some with high-vis vests, and able to respond to questions. They are being provided with cooked food, water, and oxygen as they wait to be rescued.
Samira Hussain. Now, a prominent women's rights organisation in East Africa says sexual violence has become a deliberate tactic in Sudan's civil war. Hala Al-Karib, who runs the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa, was speaking to the BBC ahead of a conference in Nairobi highlighting the impact of the conflict on women.
It's the level of dehumanization of women in Sudan. It reached a level where it got to the point where it became extremely scary and very, very worrying. The issue of abduction, for example, you know, that women has often been abducted and has been sold in specific markets around Darfur. The fact that women from Masalit tribe has been identified even in areas in Khartoum and at the peripheries of Khartoum by the RSF. This is a new pattern as well. Overall, the prevalence of sexual violence continue to increase, and reports about women and girls, you know, being violated. It's becoming part of our everyday reality. Sexual violence from day one, it was never a casualty of war. It was a war tactic. And the fact that 70% of documented cases of sexual violence are gang rape cases, so that's very telling about the fact that there is no shame, you know, by the militia committing such crime, that it's very well intended, it's well planned, and it's a war tactic to intimidate communities and to spread fear and terror among Sudanese.
That was Hala Al-Karib of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. We go to France now, where the upper house of the French Parliament, the Senate, is debating a bill to compensate people prosecuted under anti-homosexuality laws that were repealed 4 decades ago. Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, told us how these anti-gay laws worked.
You know, the odd thing is, Nick, that France was actually the first country in the world to legalise homosexuality right after the French Revolution back in 1789, while they were busy storming the Bastille and chopping the heads off unfortunate members of the royal family. They also took time to pass what was very progressive legislation on sexual freedom. However, the Nazis took over in France during the Second World War, installed a puppet government. It was known as the Vichy regime after the town where it was based. And they did decide to crack down on homosexuality. First of all, they said you had to be 21 to have a gay relationship, where it was 13 for heterosexuals. And then some offences were punished worse if you were gay, for example, indecent exposure. Now, the thing is, these laws were kept on after France was liberated. The Vichy regime fell. And they reckon, yes, 60,000 people were convicted. They often lost their jobs too, had to leave their homes. There really was widespread suffering in a country which saw itself as sexually very enlightened.
And Paul, what exactly is being offered under this proposed compensation scheme?
Anyone who was affected, who was convicted under these laws, will get a flat fee of 10,000 euros. That's about 11,000 US dollars. Anyone sent to prison will get 150 euros for every night they spent behind bars. Now, I should say not many people are expected to make this claim. Bear in mind, first of all, a lot of people have died. But there's still a lot of shame around all this. And even the sponsors admit the measure would really be symbolic. But they say an important symbol, because if homophobia persists, that's because the anti-homosexual laws of the past have not been fully dealt with.
And Paul, are there people still opposed to these new measures?
The trouble is that anything to do with France's wartime government is still very contentious. Many of the deeds committed by the Vichy regime weren't even acknowledged until the past two decades. France is sometimes seen as a country which prefers to talk about the brave resistance fighters who took on the Nazis, not the collaborators who worked with them. So this measure is going to once again force people to consider what French people did under the Nazis. Meanwhile, some gay campaigners are not happy because the new measure only compensates people targeted by these two laws. They say actually in the last few decades, homosexuals were targeted by other laws, punished for things like moral failing or inciting depravity. And bear in mind, you know, anything these days to do with sexuality, I think not just in France, gets caught up in the so-called culture wars. So I think this legislation could have a rather bumpy ride.
Paul Moss, our Europe regional editor. Finally, to South Korea, which is being marked as Kimchi Day. The tangy and often spicy fermented vegetables can be enjoyed as a side dish and added to hot pots or stirred through rice even. Traditionally, local communities got together to make kimchi in bulk during November ahead of the bitter cold winter. Nowadays, it's travelled beyond Korea's borders and onto the tables and into the kitchens of people around the world. David Kan has been hearing from its producers, and not all of them have Korean roots.
Our kimchi recipe came from this really warm-hearted Korean mother. We try to keep that authenticity based on recipe that my mother had.
This is Zoe Yoon, sales manager at Mr. Kimchi. She started the business with her husband using her mother's recipe in 2013. But their history goes a little further back.
Back in 1997, I remember people coming into the house bringing their own containers, and she used to put her kimchi into the containers.
Zoe's mother was one of many Korean expats who brought their kimchi recipe overseas. And from there, kimchi went beyond Korean communities. Dr. Cherin Park, principal researcher at World Institute of Kimchi in South Korea, explains.
일단 김치가 해외에 알려지기 시작한 건 사실 한국인이
History of kimchi outside of Korea is closely tied to the history of Korean emigration, going back to the 17th century. Koreans were making kimchi overseas, and it was so unique that it got attention from the locals. Then the global pandemic has really pushed its popularity. Nowadays, food isn't just consumed for taste, but for its health benefits.
While studies on health benefits of kimchi are still ongoing, global kimchi consumption has grown dramatically over the pandemic years. According to South Korean Customs Office, over the past 5 years, the export value of kimchi has gone up by 10% each year to 140 million US dollars, or the total weight of 41,000 tons in 2022. That is a massive jump, considering the total growth of 10 years prior to the pandemic was under 10%. And now, it's not just Koreans who are making kimchi from scratch. Tina Benson is the owner of Kimchi With Everything, based in London.
I lived in Japan for a while and then living in different parts of Asia. When I came back to the UK prior to COVID, I couldn't get hold of any kimchi and it was really frustrating. It kind of really started from that and then it progressed into a business. I've kind of kept the recipe very much like the Korean way.
In Aberdeen, Scotland, Arthur Serini, director and co-founder of Crafty Pickles, took a slightly untraditional approach.
We started with just making a kimchi-style sauerkraut, so all the ingredients that you normally find in a kimchi just made into a sauerkraut instead. So more think of like a kimchi slaw a little bit. I felt like it was maybe a bit more widely accepted by Western palate, especially up in Aberdeen, Scotland, where anything fermented was quite foreign.
But how do some of the Koreans feel about this non-traditional kimchi? Here's Dan Su, managing director at Korea Foods, largest importer of Korean food in Europe.
There's this horrible misconception that authentic food is the only food. Well, actually, as long as it's good, it doesn't really matter to an extent. As long as it isn't marketed as authentic, I'm fine with it. I think people always associate kimchi with Korea.
That was Dan Su ending that report. And I have to confess at this stage, I've never had kimchi. I must be more adventurous with my eating habits, I suppose. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Charlotta Tadzimska, and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.